where the wild dingoes call. But there's nothing so lonesome, so dull or so drear than to stand in the bar of a pub with no beer.
Welcome back. You're listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk to WLOB, 1310 a.m. There's nothing so sad as a pub without beer.
There you go.
You know, I'm Irish.
Yes, so am I.
Really?
Yes.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
But that is our intro for our guest. We've got Peter Bissell here. He's a co-owner of Bissell Brothers Brewing. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you for having me.
And before we even get going, thank you for bringing the Bissell Brothers beer. You've got two different... Which two beers do we have here today?
We have our flagship IPA, the Substance Ale. This is the beer that we started with. Then we kind of built the whole business around. And then we have our double IPA Swish here in this in these black cans here.
Oh, fantastic.
Love the
packaging. I'm learning slowly but surely to not go to any event like this empty-handed.
People kind of expect
it, right? They do, more so than I think. Because, you know, I always have access to it. It's always there when I need it.
Right.
I've seen enough sort of disappointed faces at events like this, so I'm getting better at it.
Well, that's funny. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we get going, I think it's you and your brother, it's really been a success story, and we want to talk about that, the company and the craft beer industry here in both Portland and Maine. But why don't you start a little bit talking about your background and kind of how you ended up in Maine, and then we'll talk about how you guys founded the company.
Sure. My parents went to school in upstate New York, Syracuse Forestry School, moved out west after graduation to Oregon. My father was working for the Bureau of Land Management. They had me. He saw an opening on the other coast, Maine, Baxter right. State Park.
Well, yeah, we actually had your dad
That's
on
right.
last month.
Yep. Yeah, that was how this all came about.
About
I gotta
Baxter
say, you guys did a great job with that. It was awesome.
Well, it was. We expect a lot when we have a Bissell on the air because he was a natural about Baxter State Park and forestry and all that.
And I'm going to really do my best with this interview to talk slow and sort of organize my thoughts because I feel like that's something that I need to work on. And listening to him, he's done it so many more times than me.
No.
And then, I have big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
So.
And then after this, we'll have other family members come on. We'll have Noah.
I'd love to do it with Noah here. He's working back at the shop right now.
Mixing the
brew.
But,
yep.
So when you get here, when your family moved here to Maine, and you spent a lot of time in Milo, which is kind of the epicenter of Maine, I think it's like 3 hours from the East Coast, 3 hours from the West, three hours from Canada in the South.
Yep.
What was your background in terms of either education or work? And then we'll talk about how that kind of led to getting into the craft beer business.
It's funny when you look at where you're at and you try to retrace the steps that guide you to that point. I mean, I think human beings tend to place, they don't take chance into account enough. I mean,
right.
I think it's a mixture of sort of your natural aptitudes and your background mixed with chance. Yeah, I wouldn't have gotten into this business if it weren't for Noah. And I don't think our business would have looked like it does now if it weren't for me. So, we had a great upbringing, small town. It's, you know, the kind of place that is disappearing slowly but surely, unlocked doors. Neighbors checking in. If you're up to no good, the neighbors are going to tell your parents. That type of place.
Got it.
It was idyllic in a lot of ways.
Well, you mentioned your brother Noah. So for folks listening, Bissell Brothers Beer came on the scene a few years ago, and they've really taken things by storm. Is it just you and your brother Noah are the Bissell Brothers, right?
That's right. Yep.
So he's about 25 now, is that right?
And he's 26, and I'm 32. We're six years apart.
Well, that's a pretty big gap, you know, in terms of like growing up and then as adults kind of coming together.
Yeah, I think ultimately you can only speculate, would we be close if we were closer in age? Right. In retrospect, though, it was good because we were never growing up. We were never in competition for anything.
Yeah, you were always on different teams, always different sets of friends.
Yeah. But again, it was a small enough town where everyone knew everyone, and we were always close. Of course, we all, you know, once we were both in our teen years, we each had our own sets of friends and whatnot, but we always did things together.
Got it.
And it started, you know, when we were really young, I was sort of like his guide. But as we got older and he, you know, became, you know, a young teenager, he had his own set of friends and whatnot, and I had mine, but we always still did things together. It was never like a bullying type scenario.
Got it.
We were always good to one another, and we always, you know, played video games at home and whatnot. There was always, there was, even despite the age gap, there was always plenty of things that we found common interest in, yeah. And we always had fun together. And that continued when I went to college, and you know, he would come to visit me at college, and we'd do all those types of things.
Where did you go, and what did you study in college?
I went to University of Maine. I studied, it's hard to remember sometimes.
Right.
The a mix. I graduated in 4 years, luckily.
Because up in Orno?
Yep. Not because of grades, but just because I jumped around with majors a lot. It was a mix of, I think I ended up graduating with mass communication, a major in mass communication and a minor in journalism. But it's funny. I mean, this might be a talk for another time, but it's, you know, I had a great experience at UMaine. I really did. It was incredible. And, but it didn't really, you know, my major didn't really have any bearing on where we're at today. Or
this could be a talk for today, because we definitely want to talk.
I have a lot of feelings on education. And
we've
sort
got
of the,
Peter Bissell here, and we're going to talk about beer. But what are your education? What are your feelings about education?
I just, having gone through this, and I had a photography business sort of that segued into the brewing company that Noah and I have now. And
commercial, right? Nikon or Canon guy?
Canon.
God, I've got the 5D3.
The Mark III?
Mark III.
Yeah, I've got the 2. I haven't upgraded yet, and I feel like there's you know, there's a you get a full frame camera and you got a full frame camera. The bells and whistles. I'm jealous of those cameras though when I see my friends use them. There's a couple of features on there.
Great video as well as still.
Yeah.
So your experience in Orno. So you were a young guy, you grew up, you went to, is your point that how did that prepare you for work, or would you have done things differently with what you know now, how you approach education?
I believe in the world we live in now, the institution of higher education, it still is valuable, but it's for, you know, the idea of sort of liberal studies, it doesn't mean what it used to. And if you think that you have an idea for a company or that you want to do something on your own, you need to go and work in the world.
Right.
A degree is not going to change anything for you. You still need a degree if you're going to be a mechanical engineer, if you're going to be a physician. There, you know, there is still areas where the institution of higher education directly applies. But for your own ventures, you need to get educated by, you know, living and operating in the world, taking risks, learning your own skills. The skills that we learn through, you know, this company were self-taught. And it was from operating in the real world.
Yeah.
The world of secondary education, I think, is very much closed. I think, and I didn't mean to segue into this.
It's interesting.
But so we're raised in this culture, and it's not our parents, it's not society, it's not teachers. It's a collective thing that pushes you into this realm where you believe that you're doing the hard work then and there by getting through this, getting this degree, putting the time in, especially with liberal education, which is what I have experience in. You know, it's about rounding. You have to take different credits and a variety of different studies, and this degree is going to be your ticket. You're putting the hard work in now, cramming for these tests and whatnot. And if you know at 19 that you're going to be a physician, or that you have a huge desire to be a civil engineer, to build bridges, then by all means, lean into that, because those are skills that are going to apply in the real world. But if you don't have this drive to be a certain thing that requires sort of fine-tuned mathematical or, you know, anatomical studies, then you're going to get a degree and it means so little now.
Right.
It means so much less than it did. So many people are graduating from college. Graduating from college, I feel now, is like graduating from high school 30 years ago. It's just something that's almost assumed. And we tend to look outward to these forms of you know, we look outward for validation. Like, I have a degree, give me a job. And I hear the same story again and again when folks, and I lived it, you know, I had been kind of groomed to feel that I was doing the hard work and that this degree was going to set me apart in life. It was going to put me ahead in life, and it didn't when I graduated. And I kept turning to photography, which was, you know, the first sort of passion that I had. And I realized painfully that, you know, no one was going to give this to me. I had to learn these skills myself. I had to differentiate myself and find a place for myself in a marketplace, you know, in the marketplace. And no one was going to give that to me. No piece of paper was going to do that. The world is fierce and competitive, and it doesn't care about your degree or that you did an internship somewhere. All the things that we're taught to put on our resumes, it just doesn't. The resumes end up on a desk somewhere, and no one cares.
Deb, I think we have the new commissioner of education for me.
I would agree.
I would agree too. And my perspective on education is during the 5 years it took me to graduate from Needham High School, which is a suburb of Boston. Mm-hmm. I did extensive study in wood shop and in square dancing.
But you're a great dancer.
But I'm a fantastic dancer. we live in a culture of sometimes where symbolism is given more weight than substance. And relative to education, I think for a lot of people, getting formal education, if it is specific to what they want to do, makes perfect sense. But we did, over the last few decades, look at secondary education as a symbolic thing where what school you went to was supposed to be a symbol of something. Of your worth, what your GPA was, what your grades were. And then once you graduate, companies were, and still to some degree, are expected to kind of monetize that. But once you start working on day two, of wherever you work, whether you're an entrepreneur or you work for a big company, the only real value is the intrinsic value or skills you have. And in addition to kind of the academic view that you had, and I agree with most of it, there's a real economics to it. You know, the big issue now in the presidential campaign is student debt. Billions and billions of dollars of student debt. Mm-hmm. And I interview people all the time that have undergrad and advanced degrees, and it's almost a badge of honor, like, oh, I've got $120,000 of student debt. And I always say, why do you have $120,000 of student debt? And many times, again, this is a generalization, you were talking about liberal arts, I'll interview people who have an advanced degree in French lit or European art or something, and they want to they bring up the money of the student debt, but when it comes to monetizing what they study, there's a disconnect, and then we, being the big we, are all tied into kind of the student debt discussion on, you know, to what extent the government should forgive, to what extent the government should pay. And there are a lot of people that just shouldn't go to college.
It's ingrained deeply in our culture on all levels.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it from this other perspective now. I feel like we're in the midst of an entrepreneurial revolution in this country,
right,
due to the access. I'm reading this book called How by Dov Seidman, fantastic book about how it's not what we're doing, it's the manner in which we do it. And I can't remember the quote. It was I Instagrammed it. I thought it was phenomenal. It's exerting control over people. It's about let me just pull this up real quick. So I don't want to butcher it.
No,
but
that's
it's
cool. His name's Dov, huh?
Yeah, D-O-V.
Yeah, that right there sounds smart. If somebody had a name Dov, it sounds
just that one name.
He should just go as Dov.
Kind of like Tisha. But Tisha doesn't sound intelligent.
Not like Dov. Emily's racing to the quote too.
Yes.
To quote from the book How by Dov Seidman, here's why. In today's knowledge economy, the sources of power, information, and ideas are infinite. Google gives them away for free. Because we can't hoard information or have more of it relative to others, the command and control leadership habits of the industrial age are increasingly less effective. When we look at the world through the lens of how, we see leaders shift and others even transform their habits of leadership from command and control to connect and collaborate. It's a move from exerting power over people to generating waves through them.
Yeah, that's
and
a
that
great quote.
It's knowledge is free. If you want, I mean, like my brother learned how to brew by doing his own research. And that the idea of a giant institutional gatekeeper being something that you're required to pass through, go into massive debt just to say, okay, now I'm an expert on, like you said, French literature.
And much of
it's these things that the world is open now. Information travels at an unprecedented speed.
Right.
You can learn how to do these things. And the best way to do it is to think, you know, you go back to when you were a kid. Most of us, for the things that really bring out the passion in us, we think back to these first memories that we had as a child. I remember I won a camera from McDonald's from the Monopoly game when I was in sixth grade. It was the first time I had owned a camera. And it wasn't a, you know, this is long before the age of digital technologies and Instagram and all this. And it wasn't a Polaroid. So I took photos and I had to go have them developed. But I would take sort of the kinetic photos that attract me now. You know, we had a trampoline and I would take photos of my friends. You know, I would take them from up high and all these sort of photos with interesting perspectives that I think back to that. And other moments when I became alive, you know, when I was 13, 14 years old, thinking, man, this is really exciting. And I think for most of us, we can, the things that bring out our passion, we can trace it back to memories like that we had as children. And you just need to pinpoint those and lean into those and do your own research and put the time in. No one, that's the other thing. No one wants to put the time in our culture now. That's, we want things fast. We want them easy. No one's willing to, and that's really all that separates anybody from accomplishing anything, whether you want to start a brewery or start a business of any kind, make a piece of artwork that moves people. It's the time, leaning into the time, settling into the process, and that's lost on this generation, I feel. And it was how the world operated before the 20th century. You wanted to be a blacksmith, you had to go down this journey. That's why, where the term journeyman comes from. It was years. It wasn't, oh, I want this now. I want this now. It was, you know, I graduated from with a four-year liberal arts degree. I want a job now, now, now. It was years of drudgery.
And you had to prove it. You know, you wouldn't just
be. The proof was in the work.
Yeah, that you were judged by that. We have Peter Bissell here. He is one of the co-founders of Bissell Brothers Brewery. The other thing I've always found fascinating, it's been in the news a lot in the last few years since he passed away, but Steve Jobs, one of the most influential business leaders, music innovator, computer, animated. Much of his education came from going to school, learning typeface, learning art. He went to a Buddhist temple. And it was the perspective of that stuff that allowed him to apply a different approach. So, I agree with what you're talking about with education. We could do... We'll have to do another show on education.
I would love that.
Wouldn't that be?
Yeah, that would be very cool.
Because that is the, you know, and the other thing is, just as people talk about colleges being bricks and mortar in 4 years, that was a paradigm that fit a certain period. Now, it's not about as you said, knowledge. And we grade kids more or less on memorization skills. And we don't need that.
It's
I've got an iPhone here. You have a handheld device. I could find out almost any piece of information known in the galaxy within 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And so we need people who can effectively, whether it's lead and connect, but process and think and work hard. And, let's do a show on that, too.
Love it.
Steve Jobs is a great example. And it's funny, I read a lot about Steve Jobs. I've never been much of an Apple product user,
right.
Which is funny, but his story is absolutely phenomenal. And like you said, he thought about how it would feel to use these products.
Right.
And that's so important. It's for me personally, and with Bissell Brothers, it's one of the things that I think about the most is it's not – that's why Noah and I work so well together, because my brother is a brilliant technician. He dreams about these beers, how to make them better, how to incrementally continue to make them better and never be satisfied. And primarily, I'm on the other side thinking about how it's going to feel for the people that are going to be buying these beers and spending time with them, how it's going to feel. It needs to feel good.
Right.
You know, it needs to taste good, but it also needs to feel good. The idea of coming to our shop, you know, what people think of when they think of Bissell Brothers.
The packaging, the ethos, all the other things other than just the taste.
And it matters. It matters. And engineering types don't like to acknowledge that that type of thing matters.
Right.
And it goes back and forth. You know, a lot of hardcore sales types kind of, you know, the engineers get mad at them because they're just seen as kind of always gallivanting and going out to lunch and whatnot. But the reality is both of those things matter. The feel of the product or whatever you're trying to give to the world matters just as much as like what it actually is.
Well, let's talk about, you know, we could talk about education. We'll do that next time. We'll have a whole show, but really want to talk about the success story in the business, how you and your brother, what was the first impetus? Do you recall the first time you and your brother were talking, or maybe you were out having a beer, and what was that moment that you can look back on and say, yeah, maybe we could do this?
Oh, I remember it very clearly. We talk about it all the time, and he was at the time too young to just go have beer, so it was over. He had been homebrewing at he went to Farmington. Well, he went to UMaine for the first year, but then he transferred to Farmington. He wanted a smaller feel to his education.
Yeah.
And he had gotten into homebrewing there, and he'd tell you the first time that he really kind of saw this craft beer as a thing was when he came down to live with me in Portland in the summer of 2010. So he came down to live with me for the summer, and we both worked out at a restaurant called Great Diamond Island. Or the restaurant was Diamond Cove. Diamond Cove Restaurant and Marina.
Diamond's Edge. One of my favorite restaurants. Yeah. It's in an old fort out there.
Yeah, I met my wife out there. We got a lot of good memories from out there. So he worked out there with me and a bunch of other our friends. Great summer. But he saw, you know, he was a young man at the time.
Right.
Still, a young man, but, you know, very young at the time. So he was like a sponge when he was in this city. And he saw this movement. It was the first time he'd ever had an Allagash White, you know, a beer that's ubiquitous in Portland. It was the first time he kind of saw this subculture. And he fell in love with it. And he began homebrewing in our apartment, actually. He had done it a few times prior. And then when he went back to school, he continued on that path. The following year, 2011, we were home for Thanksgiving, and he gave, this is a story that's, we kind of laugh about now, he it was me, my father, and him, and he presented his latest brew, and I drank it, and I said, this tastes like licking an ashtray.
Oof.
And my father kind of, we were all just kind of joking around in the kitchen about it. My father said, you got to go easy on him. And I said, well, hey, this is before the idea for Bissell Brothers had been sort of born, but I said, well, I don't want to like sugarcoat it. I want him to.
Well, brothers can do that.
Yeah.
You can be honest with each other.
And it's a funny little moment that I think we'll always remember. Another month or two, he starts texting me. He's back at school and he said, you know, we should do this. I know that I'm going to spend my life in beer and I don't want to go work for someone else. We should just do this ourselves. And I was running my photography business at the time, and it had really started to, you know, get its own momentum and get its own inertia. So I thought that was going to be my life at the time. But we started, you know, this era was characterized by going over our mobile data plan limits constantly, because we were constantly texting ideas throughout the day. And it seemed great to me. And the one thing about my photography business as a sole proprietor was that I could scale it only as far as I was willing to do the work and could physically and spatially within the constructs of a 24-hour day do the work. With starting a brewing company, I saw a chance to build something bigger than ourselves, and we both did.
And what was the first step from the idea when your brother called saying, you know, and he evolved from the bad-tasting beer to all of a sudden, you know, really kind of refining the art? What was the first step that turned it into a business more than a discussion?
The first step was a promise to ourselves that we were going to do this. Because even when we were first getting started and naive, we saw that this was going to be a labor. This was going to take, again, like I was talking about early, this would not come fast and easy like everyone in our society has been trained to expect things. This would be something that would be measured in months and years before this would come to fruition. And we made a pact with ourselves. All right, we're going to do this. If we're going to do this, it's not going to be talked about. I've heard so many people claim that they're going to start businesses or they're going to do this and that. It's so easy. There's right. there's no barrier to making claims. And that wasn't going to be me, and that wasn't going to be him. If we were going to take this to the next step, where we told even our inner circles about it and our families, we were going to do this. We were not going to back down. And I initially, even in those early days, the Ashtray beer was kind of a fluke. He was making great beer right from the beginning. And I instantly started thinking about the idea, again, the how it was going to feel. So we started playing around in Photoshop. The initial labels were letters. The logo comes from three Bs. And I started twisting them around in Photoshop and connecting them. It looked like a cattle brand at first because I was using this font that was...
And the funny thing is we talked about your trajectory. You know, you mentioned you were very involved with photography. Mm-hmm. Being involved with photography, obviously, in the digital world, you got involved with Photoshop, which is the platform that most mm-hmm. people... So knowing how to work with Photoshop played a role. So your interest in photography played a real role in kind of the creative design.
Absolutely.
And
conveying the idea. We live in such a noisy world now. We're getting imprinted online by hundreds, if not thousands, of different ideas every day. You have to clearly convey the brand's purpose, the brand's aesthetic, how you see the world. You have to convey that clearly and effectively every day.
Got it.
And I was primed to do that because I was already trying to do that with my other business.
So you were working on the business side and design and packaging and where we're going to sell it. Meanwhile, your brother was really focused on the recipe.
He was
and the
brewing.
Process.
We always say like the easiest way to dumb Bissell Brothers down is to say that I am the businessman and Noah's the brewer. But it really, that's like the least common denominator. You know, that's the most reduced way to say it. We've built the company together. We did the endless research to source equipment and to build the business plan, the cash flow, what things were going to cost. We did all that together. So I wasn't just crafting this whole like business because it is brewing. It's in vogue. A lot of young guys are doing it, but it's a factory. You know, you're building a factory. It's not like starting a photography business. You have a camera and a Facebook page. Right. You've got a photography business. With a brewery, you're building a factory, and it's not something that most young people are have experience in, dealing with contract work and, you know, heavy machinery and heavy equipment. So we did all that together. So I'm always quick to say that when people think that Noah's the brewer, which obviously he is, but he's the architect of the business just as much as I was.
I mean, people forget about it. I've been heavily involved in the sports business for years, and I was a sports agent and mm-hmm. proud to say I'm one of the co-owners of the Red Claws. When a lot of young people want to, and we're going to talk about Thompson Point too in a second, but when a lot of young people want to get into a field that they think is fun and sexy, a lot of people want to get into sports. You know, I was an adjunct professor for 9 years teaching sports business. Beer, you know, anyone that's been in Maine is certainly well known for craft beer, but anyone that's ever had a beer has probably said, oh yeah, I could do that. But what people forget, whether it's sports or beer or other areas like that, underlying those industries is a whole set of business skills. You have to learn and teach yourself about finance. You have to understand labor and workers' comp. You have to understand contracts. You have to understand production. You have to understand working with utilities and locations and getting a copy machine and what attorneys you need to have contracts and patent protection. And so whether the business is beer, sports, or anything else, it's great to have the passion and the skill, which you guys clearly have. But at the end of the day, it's a business, right?
Mm-hmm. I was with our distribution manager, Josh. She was actually his wife's right in the other room.
Yeah, Josh's wife, in full disclosure, Tammy Schlesinger, she works here at TideSmart, does a great job. And her husband works with you guys in distribution, right?
That's right. Yeah, he's our distribution manager, and he's about to start his own operation, Sleek Machine Distribution.
Wow.
Yeah.
Will that be connected to Bissell Brothers?
No. He will distribute our beer, but legally it's a separate entity.
Separate business?
As a brewery owner, I can't own a distribution company.
Got it.
At least on our level now. But this is that's another exciting thing for maybe another day. But he's out delivering right now. He coordinates the routes. He does all the sales. and he gets it out with our other guys that do.
Well, even the thing you just mentioned, the regulatory issue with beer and alcohol. For years, I oversaw sports marketing for Miller Brewing Company. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't realize that we have a multi-tier licensing regulatory environment, whether it's beer or alcohol, where the government, and this was after Prohibition, really set up these, I think, four different layers. You know, so the most easily recognized regulation involving alcohol and beer is the drinking age. So that's one step. And then, you know, where you're serving or selling on-premise or off-premise, you need a license if you're Hannaford or if you're a bar or the Great Lost Bear or something like that. And then you have to have a distribution company, as Peter was just talking. But Miller Brewing Company and Budweiser and Bissell Brothers or Jack Beam can't sell directly to the public. It has to go through the distribution channel because the government, part of it is taxation, but part of it is, you know, historically where alcohol and beer is fit within the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and it's so heavily regulated. But, you know, to your point, you have to understand that, and then you have to figure out distribution channels, and it sounds like you've got a new thing going on with Josh.
Well, currently, you know, Josh is a Bissell Brothers employee, so we self-distribution was a huge part of our business plan and our ethos.
Right.
You know, that removing that separation between us and our consumers, being there on the ground level, I think it's a dangerous game to play today with the amount of saturation and competition. You need to be on the ground level. You need to be on the streets, listening to what people are saying, getting a fingertip feel for the trends and the waves moving through whatever industry you operate
in. And you have a tasting room, so you really connect with people.
Well, the tasting room, you had said, you know, the three-tier system, what you're talking about.
Is consumption.
It's different in every state, the self-distribution cap. So in Maine, it's actually relatively low. So we've surpassed that, but we're in a grace period now. And then with Josh opening his outfit, you know, we'll be all set with that. But Maine is very on-premise friendly, and this is another, you know, it's a sea change that's happened in the brewing world is the tasting room. I mean, these cans, we sell most of these out of our own shop, and that differs state by state. In Maine, thankfully, you know, I'm thankful for this every day. They've done a great job with allowing the on-premise experience to flourish. People now come directly to the breweries because they want the beer from the source and they want the experience. They want to see the space. And we've done a good job, I think, with recognizing that and not treating even the industrial space as a static factory environment. I don't know if you've been, but mm-hmm. if you've been, you know what I'm saying. It's,
sure.
You walk into Bissell Brothers and it's something.
Yeah, it's cool. It's an experience.
So that's another huge ripple through the industry is the on-premise experience. That's why we're moving, because our on-premise space is too small now. It's we're very much about the user experience. The user still, you know, we're very adamant about the user getting a great experience at a bar or at a retail shop, but they, you know, the Great Lost Bear, one of our best accounts, we are very lucky that they sell so much of our beer. They have 50 or 60 other beers on tap. When you curate the experience at your own shop, it's all about you. It's the one area that you'll always have complete control over shaping for the people. So it's super important. It's all important. You know, off-premise is still very important. Most people find out about our beers if they haven't heard of us. It's through a bartender's recommendation at a bar, and then they come out to the brewery and get the full experience. So it works hand in hand. It's all important.
We have Peter Bissell here. He's co-owner with his brother Noah of Bissell Brothers Brewing. You can find out information at Bissell, B-I-S-S-E-L-L, brothers.com. They're also heavily involved with social digital media, Facebook / Bissell Brothers, Twitter, Bissell Bros Brew, and also Peter Bissell on Instagram. So talk a little bit about the first year. So you made the commitment, you and your brother, to start the business. Where do you start? And technically, aside from what you were doing in terms of setting up the company and sampling in the kitchen, talk about the first day or first week when you went from a startup to a business And I think the demarcation point is when you first you sold your first beer.
Mm-hmm.
When you know the cash register rang up and it's like, hey, we just sold the four pack, or we just sold a commercial account. When did that happen? What month or year did that happen? And how did that evolve?
So we launched on December 7th of 2013. But I'm going to backpedal just a hair.
Mm-hmm.
So from idea, from conception to execution was 2 years. And, you know, we talk about education and you know, learning in the real world and learning. That 2 years, in that 2 years time span, we raised $350,000. We set up a manufacturing outfit.
Commercially, or was it more through friends and family in terms of how you raised
them? Our initial fundraising was a mix of a bank loan and private investment. But, I mean, setting up and running a private investment round, that's worth whatever you're going to pay for 2 years of school. Mm-hmm. I learned more in that process than my 4 years of college combined. I mean, this is real life skills. And I found myself in a position where I'm doing a little super informal, but sort of light business consulting for friends of mine that are trying to get stuff going. And I've been revisiting this period a lot. And I tell them, it's not going to be easy, but there's no barrier. You don't need a degree to do this. You can learn. And I'm a huge advocate for business reading. I have a book list that I share with anyone that would ask. So that 2 years that we set up the business was such an intense period of learning. And again, you miss out on a lot of things. You have to say no to social engagements. You kind of, your perspective turns and you see the world of these people that are working in jobs that they don't necessarily care about or are invested in. They're working for that weekend. They're trying to work is seen as something to struggle through to get to the time where you're not in work. And it's a perspective shift when you're working towards something that has totally immersed you, that you love.
Right.
It's a labor of love, and you're working towards this thing that you can't stop thinking about. And you begin to see a disconnect from people that think like this with sort of most of the mainstream workforce is working to get away from work. You know, they're working to get through it so they have money to spend when they're not at work. And we work too much. Most of our adult lives are spent at work. Life is too short for that. So,
but do you think it's also a generational thing? Because you're young enough that you're kind of on the cusp of, you know, I'm part of the baby boomer generation. And then there's been all these other generations with millennials. But do you see, for many people in Maine, many people around the country, where there are younger people coming into the workforce and they don't have that same sense. It's more, you know, people talk about quality of life and, you know, and I think there has to be a balance. But to do the thing that you guys have done just in the last few years, I agree. It requires, and you have to immerse yourself in it. And I don't know if that spirit is as prevalent as it was years ago.
Yeah, I agree, and you're definitely right about it being a generational thing. And I respect that generations that came before us paved the way. They did work that they didn't necessarily love to set their families and to set society up for where we're now. It's a great time to be alive. People talk about the ills of the world. It's just because information travels more quickly. We're the safest we've ever been. You know, there's more money than there's ever been. There's more productivity in the economy than we've ever seen. You know, you've probably seen these statistics where every day now more data and information and art is created than like had ever been created from like the year zero through 1500 or these things like that. So we're on an exponential curve. So there's never been a better time to do something like this. But that being said, I definitely like respect and understand that the world hasn't always been like this and that it took generation sacrifice before to get us to this point. So that's what I call my first, the first education is the 2 years and submitting to the fact that this would not come quickly and easily. You would have to spend when your friends wanted to do something fun and, you know, a diversion, you would have to say, no, I've got to do this. And I've got to keep working towards this ultimate goal.
Does it, in your case, do you think it helped that you and your brother were in it together?
Because
he probably has the same passion for the business. And in his case, because he was the first brewer, you know, on that side of it and really getting into the ingredients, really getting into the process.
Oh, he devoted every waking minute that he had to it. And again, like I was very adamant in saying that we constructed the company together. He wasn't just sitting over the kitchen or the stovetop. He was doing all that, but he was also helping me sort, you know, figure out this very complicated.
So 100 times a day, you're still talking back and forth, yeah, whether you're focusing, yep, on business elements and he's focusing on the brewery part.
Well, my studio was above the Thirsty Pig, my photo studio. So we were hanging out in the Pig a lot anyway, and I was friends with the owner, Allison. So Noah graduated college in May 2012. And we had, at this point, we already knew we were going to do this. And, you know, his first step was to move right down to Portland. So I introduced, he needed a job. So I introduced him to Allison, the owner of the Pig. And at the time, she really needed someone like Noah, a young person that had really extensive beer knowledge. And we never pulled the wool over our eyes. We said, look, we're going to eventually leave. We're going to do this brewery. But he started working there right when he moved down. And then I got married that July. And at that time, we were seeing some of these numbers. And I said, all right, we got to put whatever we can put into this too, in addition to the fundraising. So I started working there too. And we worked there together. I was still doing all my photo work, booking as many contracts as I could, dumping it all in. But we worked there at the Pig together from July of 2012 through October of 2013. So we were together both at work, at the bar, and that kind of served as like a nucleus for us spreading our ideas.
Right.
Friends of ours would come in. We'd print shirts ourselves and give them out to our friends and supporters and whatnot. And it became this sort of grassroots thing.
That was only 2.5 years ago. I mean, you're also in an environment where people are talking about beer. They're coming in. What's good? What's the season? Seeing how people react to different ales versus different products.
And the Pig was a great sort of precursor to what we're doing now, because the Pig was at the time was only a year and a half old itself. So it was still very much a startup environment. You came into work and there was going to be a lot asked of you. Things would come up, random things would go wrong. You had to take care of it. So we would come in there and treat it like our own while we were there. You know, like, all right.
Do they serve Bissell Brothers now?
Oh, always. It's never,
always?
Oh, yeah. They're...
So they've been supportive all
zero.
The way around?
Yep, our launch party. So again, to you know, I said, let's reverse for a minute. So now we're back at the launch.
Right.
So for the past 2 years, we've gone through this very intense real-life education on how to make beer, how to construct a brand, how to convey how you feel about how you see the world, how to put that out to other people and let them embrace it, how to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars and go through that very rigorous process. So we're at launch now. So that's the first education. And I always tell people, again, this, when friends and people looking to get something going themselves talk to me, then the first 6 months is your second education, because that's when you're out existing in the world now. All kinds of things are going to go wrong.
Right.
You're still constantly learning every day. Noah didn't come into this from some other brewery. We were all learning how to use this intimidating process equipment,
packaging
and machinery
equipment,
right on the job, right out of the gate.
Is the filler getting it to the top? You know, what's the quality control? Is the ink staying on the cans?
The first year was filled with endless, you know, things. Every day that we'd wake up and I'd drive out there thinking, what's going to happen today? What's going to go on? You know, but as part of it is you just keep going. And it gradually got more streamlined. New bigger problems that we couldn't have foreseen would then come up. And again, this ties into self-sufficiency and finding things out for yourself and being self-reliant and stoic. You learn to not react emotionally when something goes wrong. And I'm a huge, I needed to learn this more than anything, because when we launched, I was fairly gripped with fear because we didn't know what we were doing. We had beer out there and the beer tasted phenomenal, but every day was a struggle. And it was just because we were still learning so much.
But what was the beer environment like? You know, there's a lot of beer companies here.
Mm-hmm.
Were people generally supportive?
Yes.
Or is it still very competitive with you and the other, you know, microbrews? And who are some of the people that really helped when maybe they didn't have to help?
Competition is a funny word with beer, especially in the local sphere, there is competition. You know, you read about in the national, but beer exists on so many different levels. You have big beer, you have Miller Coors and Anheuser-Busch, and you have national craft beer brands that are, they're not Miller Coors, but they have huge facilities.
Sam Adams,
Sierra Nevada, these types of companies. And you have regional breweries that, you know, serve a region, Victory in Pennsylvania, let's say. Allagash could be considered that too. They're on the West Coast, but they're not in every convenience store in America. And then you have small local breweries like us. And this ties into really, if you start a brewery now, you got to know, even when we started, you have to have a very clear identity. You have to know what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. So we knew we were going to be hop forward beers. We both love hops. We love IPA. There was a position in the market for this new type of IPA to emerge that pushed the aromatics, that pushed the taste without just bombarding you with bitterness. And that was what we set out to do. And I firmly believe that it's not just in beer. It's in, if you want to start a company of any kind now, every market is saturated. Every need that we as consumers have now is met. So you've got to appeal to a niche audience, and it's probably even more niche than you would think. You've got to go deep, and you've got to be the dream company of whatever your industry is. You've got to be the dream company for a small group of people, and they will love you for it, and they will tell friends that share similar interests. The biggest problem I see is breweries opening, and again, any type of company for that matter, they're trying to open and they're trying to be everything to everybody, and that there's just no room for that type of thinking anymore. I see breweries open with, you know, 10, 12 taps of a multitude of different styles, all these types of things that they felt like trying to appeal to. Oh, I'm not an IPA guy, but I like dark beer. Okay, well, we've got that guy. No, the trouble is there's another brewery somewhere that are dumping all their passion into stouts. So they're going to go there, you know, or with IPAs, et cetera, et cetera. So you really need to, it doesn't mean that you need to just do one beer, but you need to have an ethos. Everyone associates us with hop experimentation and kind of pushing the hop boundaries because that's what we said we were going to do, and that's where our passions lie, and that's what we do. We did a fruit beer last summer with, about 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of berries from Pownal. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not like you can only do one thing, but that was the exception to the rule for us. Have fun, experiment, but don't try to be everything to everybody because there's just no space for it now. And so, it's scary to consciously alienate a part of the public, but it's what you got to do. You can't be a mediocre offering to everyone because all those people are finding what they really love in other products.
In the last few minutes we have, talk a little bit about the current business. Where you guys are sold, whether it's on premise or whether it's in grocery, and what in the near term are the growth plans for Bissell Brothers Brewery?
Right now, we have about 65 draft accounts throughout the state of Maine. Most of them are in Portland, or you know, the greater southern Maine area. Most of them are in Portland, but we do make trips to Bangor. And Josh just did a humongous route on Tuesday, went to Sugarloaf, Freiburg, Farmington, Bridgeton, all these, because there's great things happening with dining and beer in all those places. So it's we want to make sure that the beer goes to good places in Maine. The same with Route 1, especially this summer. But primarily for the package product, it's on premise. You come to the brewery, we release three brands. We release Substance every day that we're open. And then we'll have two other brands every week. We're open Wednesday through Saturday. We do allocate some to go to the stores. We have a great relationship with all our retailers.
What retailers are you in right now?
We send beer out in Portland to Beer Cellar on Forest Avenue, RSVP, also on Forest Avenue. The Ono Cafe on the West End, great little spot. The breakfast sandwiches are probably what they're known best for, but they have a phenomenal beer and wine selection.
What's the growth trajectory? Because obviously, you know, we want to talk about moving to a new facility and that affects capacity. But what do you think the next year or two looks like in terms of growth and expansion, either in Maine or becoming more regional?
Noah and I had a great talk about this on Super Bowl Sunday. I had some people over to, you know, drink and have some food. And we got into a great discussion about this. And it's I think breweries are addicted to growth. You know, you get more stainless in there and it's just easier and easier to add tanks and make more beer. But I do think the other shoe is going to drop because so much great beer is being made locally throughout the country that we are coming back to a time now in the beer scene where a local brewery is just that local. So we're going to grow to meet the demand that we see at our shop now on premise. I'm sure we'll add more tanks and I'm sure in 5 years my perspective will be totally different. But one thing that Noah and I have always, you know, held paramount is slow, sustainable growth. So this move is the biggest sort of shock to that, but we're increasing capacity by about 40%.
Well, talk about the move and the timing and what that means for the company.
The opportunity for Thompson's came up about a year ago. So I should disclose to anyone listening, we are moving to Thompson's Point, which is a development. It was previously industrial. It's now going to be mixed use. It's near the train station in Portland.
I should also disclose that I was part of the ownership group of Thompson
Point.
Right. And right by the airport, when you're on 295, there's an ice rink out there and some big brick industrial buildings. So when do you move and what does that mean for capacity?
We will start physically moving on May 1. There will be our new equipment will be down there already, piped in. What it means for the on-premise experience is a bigger, less claustrophobic feel because we're very busy now. We've been busy for a while. In the summer, it's easier to manage because we have the big deck, but in a month like now, it's all inside and there's just not enough space. You will see a big, beautiful tasting room with an open concept, a second floor mezzanine where you can take beers up and watch the production and watch the brewing, and you'll be on a site with probably the best place to watch a sunset in Portland. And it'll be our ethos and our aesthetic and the beers that you already love and already know, as well as a couple new ones that we're really, really excited about. Everything that we're trying to do in an industrial way now, just that on a slightly larger scale.
Well, we've run out of time, but it's been great having you here, Peter.
And thank you. Thank you for the interest. And I think we touched on a lot.
It's an interesting subject that goes all over the place, but people can find more information at your website, right? Bissell Brothers?
BisselBrothers.com. Our Instagram, at Bissell Brothers, posting a lot of photos on products that we have now and what's going on at the shop now, as well as the move. And yeah, I was just down there this morning. They're pouring the concrete. It was really exciting.
That's really exciting.
And Twitter, at Bissell, BISSELL, Bros, BROS, Brew, BREW. Facebook's easy enough to find. But for the real day-to-day stuff, I would say Twitter and Instagram are the way to go.
Well, I wish you and your brother a lot of luck. You know, I'm a big supporter of entrepreneurs and people that really roll up their sleeves. And you guys in the last couple of years have really been crushing it. So wish you guys the best of luck and hope you come back sometime and we'll do a whole show on education because I think you have some really interesting perspective and views.
Thank you so much for the interest and your time.
It's been great having you. That's been Peter Bissell, co-owner with his brother Noah, Bissell Brothers Brewing. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We'll be back next week.